You're listening to Strictly Business Podcast with Lindsay Williams.
My next guest is the founder of ETM Macro Advisors. His name is Russell Lamberti. He's not a prolific tweeter, but he's certainly a provocative tweeter. Russell, what are you provocative about at the moment? Because we go into this interview not really knowing any script, but is there anything that irks you or pleases you at the moment?
Wow, that's a very broad canvas you've given me there, Lindsay. Good to be with you again.
Thank you.
Look, I think that we have this fascinating political fight going on in the United Kingdom, and I'm not particularly irked one way or another. I think it's just a really interesting shakeup of a system that was probably in need of a shakeup for a number of decades.
Just before you go on, you think that it's then it's actually refreshing to see a shakeup of the system, as you call it, because from my point of view, and I come from the other side, the actions and the words and the deeds of Donald J. Trump is emboldening other leaders to do the same. And I think it's nice to have a shake-up every now and again, but I think in the short term, and maybe even the medium term, that this shake-up, as you call it, is actually counterproductive.
Well, I think you might very well be correct on that score. I mean, I think that when you shake something up, things fly out the window and things break. And so I'm not saying this is an orderly, one-way street sort of issue. I think that there's all sorts of uglies that are being revealed. And look, I think that the way Donald Trump has been talking and tweeting, and I think he tweeted something today or yesterday to the effect that he had unparalleled and great wisdom. So there's a level of narcissism there that even if you've been sympathetic towards the kind of populist movements, must give you some pause for concern and reflection when as the old scripture says, pride comes before a fall. I know people are trying to equate Boris Johnson to Donald Trump. I think that there is a world of difference between them, and there's a world of difference between the systems that they lead. And I don't think Boris is another mini Donald Trump, as people are trying to paint him. It's a good attempt at a political rhetoric strategy, but I don't think it works. I actually think that the British system does need this shakeup, and I'm not saying it's going to be easy, and it may ultimately result in Scotland way. It may result in more federalism. It may result in a written constitution, which I know a lot of people would try and reject in the UK. But, I think my line on this has been that Brexit is so much bigger than Brexit. and I think that's still probably true. I think that it's revealing so much more than just the technocratic reality of leaving or staying in the European Union.
So what you're saying is that Brexit is just merely a manifestation of a serious, almost structural malaise in the United Kingdom, which has been going on for decades. I mean, that's my interpretation of what you've just said.
Well, I think what it's saying is that, it's revealing a few things. I think it's revealing the some of the shortcomings of the unwritten British constitution. Now, I think that there's shortcomings of written constitutions as well, but this is potentially one of them. And with change or a negative change end up through this whole process with a written British constitution similar to what they have in the United States, updated for the 21st century, that may, as a result, then additionally allow for greater level of political and perhaps even fiscal decentralization in the United Kingdom. We know that the way that the UK is structured right now is that London is the center, and London controls and pretty much dominates the entire whole. And we know that we've got large cities and large regions, particularly up in the north, that are very much essentially kind of welfare dependencies on London. And I think it would be very healthy in the long run for the UK to have a decentralized fiscal model. I think Scotland is really desperate to break away from the UK's from fiscal dependency on the UK. That whole process is not going to be without controversy, and it's going to be fraught. So look, I think this is opening up a whole can of worms. And, you know, it probably says more about the United Kingdom than it does about the European Union. I've come around more and more to the view that the vote to leave was probably an expression of general domestic political angst, you know, at least as much as it is not wanting to be governed from too far away in Brussels and perhaps submitting to all these European regulations. But I think it says a lot about what's going on in the UK. And so I think that this political volatility has only really just begun.
Sorry to interrupt you. I think that what happened in the UK when that stupid vote was called by David Cameron, whose book has just been released and he's on this book tour at the moment, I think the stupidity of that narcissistic vote of his has manifested itself over the last 3 and a bit years, and it will come back to haunt him for the rest of his life. I believe that people who live in villages in, for example, Suffolk or Norfolk, couldn't get their children into nursery schools because of immigrants from Eastern Europe, for example, Polish people or Albanians who are doing a fine job in the UK, doing jobs at lower wages than UK citizens would. And because of their presence and the fact that they are taking the nursery school places and that sort of thing, they voted with their feet. And it was a giant political miscalculation. We mustn't assign too much credence to the intelligence of the UK population. It was just a giant mess up.
You see, I disagree, Lindsay. I think that, and I know you and I disagree on this.
Good.
Now, I think that if you're an ordinary Brit and you do have a lot of foreigners coming in, working for less and taking school places, I mean, I don't see why that's something to not have discomfort about and to be a little bit angry about. You know, there's probably, you know, 10 million people in India who would work for lower wages than many South Africans. I mean, should we import 10 million Indians into South Africa to create even lower wage, you know, manufacturing operations or what have you? Now, even if you want to make that argument, you've got to wrestle with and grapple with the hard cultural, political reality that would entail. And so I do think that migration flows are an existential question in Europe. Are they being answered? Is that existential question being answered in the right way in every instance? No. Will it harbor within it some unsavory, you know, very far right, very racist elements? Yes. Is it all an illegitimate racist complaint? No. I mean, I think that there are legitimate nationalist complaints and desires to self-determine within a political unit. And so I think whether the Brexit vote happened in June 2016 or not, I think that these existential questions were going to bubble to the surface. And I think on a long enough timeline, I don't think David Cameron will be that integral in the historical analysis of this episode. I think that this was an inevitability at some stage. The British have always had an uncomfortable relationship with Europe and with the European Union. What was signed up for in the days of yore, and what Maggie Thatcher thought she was doing by deepening Britain's involvement with the European Union, I think has probably not quite been what she expected. And I think it's deviated to a large extent from those original intentions. So, you know, I would say that Cameron was a player in a tragedy that was unfolding regardless. And I think that the UK are having much more honest political conversations as a result than they would have otherwise from that vote. And I think that they're having much more honest conversations than many of the rest of Europe is having. And I think that ultimately that's healthy. But in the short term, there is a political risk discount that is being applied to the UK. And so if we bring it back to the markets, you can see why sterling has been on a sustained basis struggling to make headway. And as long as we have this significant degree of uncertainty about how the politics shakes out in the UK, and until other European countries start having equally uncomfortable debates and conversations, pound sterling is going to be on the back foot.
Yeah, okay, we'll talk about the markets in a moment. I will say one thing, that I saw an interview with a former cabinet member who has now suddenly gone independent, former MP, former cabinet member, and he decided, no, he doesn't like party politics anymore. And one of the most telling things that I saw in this BBC interview was that he said that when he sits down, when he used to sit down with the cabinet, he said that the level of understanding, the level of intelligence, the level of knowledge was frighteningly bad. And he said, that's it for me with party politics. And I think that the political system used to be quite an austere and august institution, if you like. And now you've got people like Donald Trump and Boris Johnson at the top, self-serving people. I consider them both self-serving. And suddenly we're ruled by people that only want one thing, and that is to be the loudest voice in the room.
Well, the question is, are politicians becoming worse in quality, or do we know about it more than we ever used to because of the kind of information world that we live in? We live in a world now where access to insight and information and analysis is so much more widespread than it ever has been in history. We now swim in this water, so we don't think about it a lot. But it's easy for everyone now to play prime minister from their phones. And so it does make these people look particularly ordinary. Now, I'm not denying that there have been some, someone like Donald Trump is an extraordinary individual, an extraordinary person who says outrageous things and who is certainly not in the usual mold, at least as far as people's public personas are concerned.
He's rude. He's arrogant, yeah. And let's face it, he's stupid, because if he wasn't stupid, then he would have released his academic results. It's very, very simple. There are certain things. We talk about Trump every day because he's so visible and he's so prolific when it comes to social media. But the fact is that he won't release his academic results because they are so poor, presumably. And he's very stupid, and he leads the United States of America. And I don't care what anybody says about, he cuts taxes and unemployment is at its lowest level for 50 years at 3.5%. That's not the point. Anyone can do that. Anyone can cut taxes. Anyone can increase the deficit. He's a liability.
Well, I think he certainly the way he tweets and some of his rhetoric, particularly recently, I think is I think you're right. I think that there is a liability component to that. Politics is also, however, about instinct. And I think some of his instincts are very good and I think are correct. And
for
I think
example?
The instinct, so I think that the instinct around – so if you look at Europe, if you look at the United States, the instinct around being cautious in a world where movement has never been easier, I think is certainly electorally – a very, very good instinct. I mean, Trump won the election, let's not forget. And he's probably going to win in 2020. So a country of 330 million people will elect this person twice. Now, we can talk about his intellect all day long. I think that there's probably been many, many pretty stupid leaders across many countries, across the world, across time. Trump has managed to get into a position of immense prominence in a huge and powerful country. But he, I think, is a symptom of a social backlash to a dispensation that we've had for a number of decades in which a ruling class has encircled the imperial city of Washington, has entrenched itself in Westminster and various other centers of political power. And, no one said populism was going to be pretty and neat and nice, but this backlash is the start of a political realignment process. So I think if you can try and be a little bit dispassionate about what we're seeing, I'm a little more ambivalent on someone like Trump or someone like Boris Johnson, and not get too emotional about their particular personas and their characters and what they maybe personally
How can you be dispassionate about something? Human beings, no matter how many computers or artificial intelligence programs you have, the fact is that the world is run by human beings. When I was at school, when I was 12 years old, there used to be sort of a vote every year for the person that would be in charge of the class. And one rich kid once said, I'll give you free sweets if you will vote me as the head of the class, that is Donald Trump. He's the free sweeter. He just doles it out with absolutely no idea of what the consequences will be.
Okay, no, but the only difference between that and any other major European leader of the last 50 years is that Trump doesn't pretend, Trump is transparently kind of not serious, and he does it in a far more open way. But I mean, European leaders have been doling out free goodies. European leaders have been running up deficits. European leaders have been overtaxing their populations. They've been running these huge and unwieldy welfare states. I mean, the European Union and the Eurozone, as an example, is hardly a bastion of success. And all these problems are now coming home to roost. The fact that a politician might get up and wear a serious suit and say some serious lines doesn't really negate the fact that they're doing some pretty clownish things. And Trump is in many ways just a lot more transparent about his actions. And in some ways, what's good about Trump is that the way he goes about his business makes it quite transparent how politics is failing people, and how this sort of statist and centralist, central government-led political process doesn't really work for people on the ground. And this is precisely why I'm such a big advocate for political decentralization.
Do you honestly believe that when Donald Trump tweets 30 times a day, and when he comes onto the Fox News network or whatever network it is and stands just before he gets on his helicopter to go and have a game of golf, do you honestly believe that his mind works in that way? He doesn't do it for the United States. He doesn't do it for the Republican Party. He does it for himself. I can't believe, Russell, that you're saying that when he stands up and says something, that he's actually thought it through. He's just doing it for himself. The reason he wants interest rates low is because his so-called empire is in so much debt, and so he doesn't have to repay that debt at such a high rate. This is my contention. I'd love you to come back
okay,
with
so,
that one.
Name me a politician who doesn't do things for themselves.
No, they do things for themselves, but they also do things for the party or the country which they represent. Donald Trump does everything for himself. That's simple. We've seen that over the last, 2.5 years.
So I'm just interested in how you would prove your statement that say Tony Blair did things for Britain, but Donald Trump don't do things for the United States. I think you're making an assertion, but I'm not sure you're providing strong evidence, and I'm not sure this would be the platform to lay that out sufficiently. But I think we've seen a lot of self-serving leadership for the past number of decades, and you know, Trump I think has a very different style, and he's certainly more reckless in the way that he goes about his business. But I mean, do you think that Obama, who's now able to afford a 15 million seaside house at Martha's Vineyard, is not self-serving? Do you think Hillary Clinton, who's created a huge crony slush fund over the last number of decades with her husband, are not self-serving?
Yes, but money. Well, you're talking about money now. I'm talking about ideology. I'm talking about.
No, but I'm coming back on your point, because I think that we're dealing with a ruling class that is very, very self-serving. And so, getting back to this meta discussion of what is Brexit, I think, and what is Trumpism? I mean, I think that we do well to try and, if we can, extend our political horizons a bit further out and a bit longer than the specific personalities driving things in the very short term. And let me give a quick example of this, of how we could think about this in the here and now about the future.
Yes.
People think that a Scottish independence movement would be a left-wing, pro-European, SNP-driven movement. And that is probably correct in the short term. But in the long term, what do we know about Scotland? We know that it's an inherently conservative place. We know that it's a very proud and independent place. And we know that some of the greatest innovations and some of the greatest works of literature and so on have come out of Scotland. And so we would actually, I think, in the long term, see an independent Scotland become a much more conservative country. run on pretty free market principles with, yes, a bit of a welfare state, but nothing like the kind of leftist welfare sort of dependency jurisdiction that it has become. And so I would be pro-Scottish secession, not because I'm pro Nicola Sturgeon and the kind of leftist sort of pro-European route that she would want to take, but because I think if I draw out a long enough political timeline, I think it would be a tremendously healthy step for a tax-dependent, welfare-dependent country to go independent and re-exert that good conservative Scottish spirit that it's always had. And I think we must think about these things on longer time horizons than the individuals. So to bring it back to Trump, who is, I totally understand, a very controversial, unorthodox, in many ways, crazy human being.
You're being too kind. Controversial and unorthodox. He's a lunatic.
Yeah, but I did finish with crazy. I did finish with crazy.
Oh, well done.
And so I think that he, we've got to understand what's going on in the United States, at a higher level than Donald Trump. Why did people resonate so much with Trump? Why did he resonate so much with people? Sorry. Why will he very likely be elected for a second time? And what is happening for a vote like Brexit, for example, to succeed? I mean, you talk about it being a crazy thing that Cameron did. Well, it's not that crazy because the motion that he put up that everyone thought was going to lose actually won. And now we're having much more intelligent conversations about very important and existential issues. Whereas, as I like to say, if the vote had been 52-48 instead of 48-52, we'd be talking about what hat David Cameron was wearing to Ascot. But instead, we're having proper existential questions about the makeup of the British Constitution, the relationship to Europe, the issue of immigration, which is a real existential issue. And so I think I'm very happy that we've been launched down this road, but it is a bit like lancing a boil, and it's not going to always be a pretty process.
No, it's very much not. I mean, I've never had a boil that's been lanced, but I can see it in my mind, and it's really not very pretty at all. So let me just get this straight for the last few minutes of this interview. Are you a Trumpist? You support Trump, and do you support Brexit? I need to ask you these things because this could affect our future relationship.
What I've already said in this interview is that I'm quite ambivalent when it comes to Donald Trump, and so I guess I'd reject the false choice of being pro or anti-Trump. George Bush used to get up and say, "You're either with us or you're against us," and I reject that sort of choice as well, particularly when it comes to politics and geopolitics. So I'm not with Trump. I agree with Trump on some issues. I disagree with Trump on numerous issues. But for example, his basic instincts around withdrawing U.S. troops from certain conflicts and to essentially imperfectly but slowly sort of de-escalate the U.S. empire, that's a very, very good political instinct. His trade tariff instincts, on the whole, I dislike considerably. His stuff on immigration is partly sensible and partly completely unrealistic, for example, when it comes to Mexico. So I don't subscribe to a pro or anti-Trump narrative. Am I pro-Brexit? Yes.
Why?
I've been explaining to you, but I think on the whole, I think it's very, very important that we have more political decentralization rather than less. South Africa suffers from the same problem. We have too much political centralization in Pretoria, and we need far more of it in the regions. We need fiscal autonomy in the regions, and the same is true
Fiscal autonomy feeds down from a central economy. So the regions have to be fiscally autonomous because of the policies of the central government, surely. And the South African system is in disarray at the moment, I would have thought. We'll come to that later.
No, I think what you're doing is you're making a status quo into an argument. There's nothing inherent in a central fiscal authority that has to cause it to perpetuate itself forever and ever. We could have fiscal decentralization in South Africa, where if you live in the Western Cape, you pay most of your tax to a Western Cape government, and that money gets spent in the Western Cape. The US works a lot like this. There's a lot of fiscal decentralization in the United States. In some states, the bulk of your taxes are really state taxes. So the same could be done in the United Kingdom. If you look at Brexit as a whole, what you're taking back is judicial and legislative authority. And I think that what you find is that a competition between nations, a true competition in the same way that you would have corporate competition in a decentralized market, is an incredibly healthy thing. And if you go back in through the centuries in Europe, what you had was very competitive political jurisdictions. And I think in modern times we can have a decentralized Europe that cooperates on a number of issues, that are friendly, that talk to one another in a central forum, but that aren't required all the time to accede to blanket migration standards, to the same sorts of customs standards across 500 million people. That's a degree of trade differentiation, policy differentiation, is actually extremely healthy. And I think the UK, if they can break away from Europe's financial sector sort of directives, I think London can actually position itself contra the narrative as a incredibly enticing financial jurisdiction and destination for capital. And so I think that the UK actually has an opportunity to really do some very interesting and innovative things and outcompete Europe. And I think if you look at these negotiations, these Brexit negotiations, I think that what I see amongst the European Union officials is a fear that that's precisely what London will do. And in fact, if you get into the nuts and bolts of these customs union and trade negotiations, and you look at some of the EU negotiators' demands, they're petrified that Britain is going to undercut them and outcompete them. And I think that is gives you a sense of how pernicious a lot of these European rules and restrictions and regulations are. And I think Britain can leapfrog that in a very powerful way.
You make now, a very good point. Russell, to interrupt. You make a very good point. But the Brexit negotiations are not negotiations. They're a complete farce. I would have said that 3 years ago, after the vote to leave the European Union, the government should have sat down with Europe and said, we don't want to leave, we just want to renegotiate the rules for us, because there are 27 or 28 countries, how many it is, in the Eurozone. Let's just be a little bit creative here. We want to stay in the European Union because the administrative burden and the bureaucratic burden of being in the Eurozone or leaving the Eurozone is so onerous that we don't want to indulge ourselves in it. So let's just renegotiate somewhat, because we're all individuals. Bulgaria versus Britain? No, two completely different countries. Why did they have to take 39 months or whatever it is, 3 years plus, to do this? Nobody thought laterally they could have done it so much better. And now I'm hearing people saying, well, it's the time to work out Brexit with 2 weeks to go. I mean, come on now.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, this is part of, I think, what Brexit has done, is that it's actually forced an issue. And then Theresa May tried to essentially unforce the issue by dithering, and Boris Johnson has re-exerted the forcing of the issue. I mean, that's all he's really done. He's come in and he said, we're going to deliver this thing. And he's actually forced the European Union negotiators, who I don't think were negotiating in particularly good faith, to have to think again and have to, you know, take a second look at everything. I mean, for example, the EU is trying to insist that no one builds a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, but no one will build a hard border. So it's an ineffective and unnecessary request. So I think that the EU negotiators are being shown up every bit as much as the British negotiators. I think Boris Johnson is trying to force an issue to deliver a huge democratic mandate, even if it was a close one. Look, it's not the end of the story. Even if we get a hard Brexit on the 31st of October, which you can look at your local bookie site to see what the odds are of that in the marketplace.
Yes.
But whatever happens come that date, it's not the end of the story. You know, this is still something that's creating deep fissures through the British system, and I think therefore is evidence that all was not well in the state of Denmark, so to speak.
Mm.
But before the vote, and so you know, you can live in a fantasy world where David Cameron is arguing with some neo-Blairite over some technocratic little contrivance, or you can get into much more deep and existential politics, and we've chosen the latter. It may not be comfortable for all of us, but I think we're finally having much more important political conversations than we would have absent that vote.
I think the democracy has failed itself, or rather the idea of democracy has been proved to be a failure by the fact that the UK has decided to leave the European Union. As I said, it should have stayed in the European Union but renegotiated its deal. What about South Africa, Russell? We've been arguing Trump
Lindsay, could I just ask you a question? How is a referendum with a particular decision a failure of democracy?
It's a failure because people were misled by Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson stood up and said, this is how much we pay per week to the European Union, and it's been proved to be wrong. He lied like Donald Trump lies. So people, I mean, have you ever lived in the UK, Russell? Have you ever lived in England?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, when you walk down the street, would you say the person that crossed the street ahead of you is qualified to decide on the future of the country? Would you say that?
Okay, but where in the world is that person qualified?
Nowhere. That's why democracy is such a failure.
Okay. So are you criticizing Brexit, or are you criticizing the very concept of democracy?
I'm criticizing the very concept of democracy because I don't think that I am qualified to decide the future of a country. I think that people watch television in England and go on their smartphones and look at social media and say, oh, well, actually, oh, no, I like what that Boris Johnson says, and he's got a nice accent, and so therefore I should vote against remaining in the European Union because he's got a posh voice and he's been educated at Eton and Oxford. People don't understand anymore.
Okay,
people are not qualified to vote. I'm sorry.
Okay, so then if you are a democracy skeptic and you're pro, say, the European project and European centralization, then you would be someone who is pro governance by an appointed elite.
No, not an appointed elite, an appointed academic elite.
Okay, so what you're taking is a very rationalist Enlightenment perspective that we're best governed by a few intelligent,
yes,
well-educated people who make the right decisions for us.
Yes,
I'm also a democracy skeptic. But here's what I think. I think that if you're going to have a ruling elite, which you are always going to have, regardless of your system, there will be an elite who makes choices. The question we have to ask ourselves is: do we want them making choices about 500 million people, or do we want them making choices about 1 million people in Bristol? And where I'm coming from is to say that as we decentralize power, we diminish the risk of error. Because when we get error in small places, it can be quickly learned from other jurisdictions, and we can ring fence that error. But if we centralize power amongst a technocratic elite governing over hundreds of millions of people, and they make a mistake, the mistake is catastrophic in the Soviet Union, where a technocratic elite made central decisions for an entire unit.
Like
and
Donald Trump, you mean?
One's got to be very careful. Well, so I think that there is tremendous risk in the ongoing centralization of power in Washington, and who centralized power tremendously in Washington over the last 10 to 20 years. If you look at the policies that did that, it was the Obama administration. Obama was a personable guy who had who was sensible. He was diplomatic. He spoke very, very eloquently. But he centralized a lot of functions additionally into Washington, as did George Bush. And then what happens is you do that, and then suddenly you get the president that you don't like. What happens when we get the European Union technocrats that we don't like? And suddenly you've got a problem where you've got people making decisions over hundreds of millions of people. And so I'm all for decentralization of U.S. power to the states, and I'm all for decentralization of European power to the nation states, and then to even sub-regions within those states. I think UK is crying out for further decentralization.
UK is crying out for a leader. The UK is crying out for economic growth. The UK is crying out for all sorts of things at the moment. Would you say that Catalonia should split from Spain?
I would be in favor of that kind of that kind of move. I think that Europe is the rallying cry in most of Europe is actually not towards a mega state European Union. It's actually towards local autonomy. And you know what's wonderful about the modern era is that we actually have the information and the technology and the means and mechanisms to seriously decentralize power. And if you look at the Balkans, the countries that remain the most unstable are the countries that haven't provided sufficient political autonomy yet to the different competing groups within that country, like Bosnia, for example. Whereas Croatia and Slovenia, who gained their independence 20, nearly 30 years ago, have been extremely stable countries. So yes, I think that Catalonia has a fairly good case for secession. And you know, often these things aren't worked out peacefully, and clearly there's a lot of feeling in Spain. But I think Scotland has a great case for breaking away. Wales probably has a good case too, but I don't think the Welsh people necessarily want it badly enough. No, I'm serious. I mean, the population of Wales, I'm estimating, is around, off the top of my head, around 5 million people.
Mm-hmm.
The population of Singapore is about the same. There's absolutely no reason why you can't have very, very successful countries and more political autonomy. And by the way, I think that what Brexit is ultimately unearthing is a move towards a more federalized United Kingdom. Certainly it's possible, and where you get more regional authority and more regional autonomy. And I think, by the way, it's going to be very, very healthy, even if slightly painful. I think it's going to be healthy for parts of the United Kingdom that have become welfare dependent and have lost their dynamism. Perhaps even a place like Liverpool comes to mind, which is a proud old industrial city that its only claim to fame is a football team, but it should be
Beatles as well. Don't forget the Beatles.
Yeah, the Beatles. But it should really be a modern bastion of commerce, and it's not that. It's very much a welfare dependent.
So what you're saying is, let's have a look at it this way. Let's say you're an Italian family or a French family, and you all living in this giant spread, either in Provence or in Tuscany or somewhere like that. Okay.
Yeah.
And you've got your grandmother and your grandfather living in one part of the house, and you've got yourself and your wife living in another part with your four children, and then you've got uncles and aunts it's an extended family in the house. What you're saying is that everybody should have their own little bedroom, they should do their own cooking, and there shouldn't be a collaboration between all these different units of the family, because that's what the Eurozone ideal is, a family of 27 nations.
So what you've tried to do there is use a clever analogy, but I could double the analogy back to you and say, should they all share the same room?
No, they should all share the same facilities.
Okay, so what you're saying is that they're going to separate themselves for certain functions, and they're going to cooperate on other functions. And there's nothing about Brexit that prohibits cooperation with other European nations.
There should be a compromise. I think there should be a unity. A Eurozone unity, and I think that each country should have its own special rules, and it shouldn't be prescribed by one particular rule. You can't have a cucumber that is bendy, for example. I mean, that's a stupid analogy, or rather, example.
But Lindsay, that's precisely what Brexit can achieve. Brexit can achieve.
Because Britain is leaving the Eurozone. How can it achieve something when it's left it?
No, no, Britain's not been part of the Eurozone. You meant the European Union.
That's what I mean.
So Britain. Okay, but what is it there for? What is it leaving? It's not leaving Europe. It's not changing its geography. It's not going to be not friends with the French and the Germans. It's not going to stop talking to the rest of the Europeans about terrorism threats and Russian threats. There's all manner of international relations that will continue after October the 31st, if indeed that is the date of Brexit. I mean, this you're adopting the Tony Blair line where he literally says we're leaving Europe. To equate the European Union, which is a technocratic structure, to leaving the cultural, geographic, historical alliances that we call Europe. That's just completely false and misleading. The UK can leave a technocratic arrangement and still have very, very friendly relations with the rest of Europe, as it will. As you will see, it will certainly have good relations with Europe.
What you don't understand is the psychology of Europe. The French hate the British. The French hate the Germans. The Germans hate the Belgians. You don't understand the psychology of the whole thing as well, because you've depersonalized it. Russell, you honestly, I mean, I love your theories and everything, but unfortunately, you're naive in that regard. I do believe that you have to sit down and say, yes, Bulgaria and Britain are completely different countries. Let's sit down around the table and say, Bulgaria, your wine exports should only be taxed at 10%, and Britain, your beer exports should only be taxed at 5%. People should get together, but they should still stay as an economic and fiscal union. That is my belief.
Okay, well, so that they're not a fiscal union in the whole. There's a currency union,
yes.
But now what you've just said is that you've actually made an argument against the customs union. You've actually argued for different tariff rates and for different treatments of different countries.
Yes, of course there should be. There should be flexibility
exactly.
within the union.
So I'm pro Brexit. You're pro radical reforms of the existing European Union.
Yes, I am.
Okay, so that's great, and I understand exactly where you're coming from. How likely those reforms are to take place?
Zero.
So the next option then is how likely is it for a country to be able to break away? And what we're finding is that it's non-zero for the UK. Now they haven't broken away yet, and it's proving to be extremely difficult because there's a whole lot of people who don't want it to happen, and they're trying to re-exert that political pressure. But if you don't think that 27 countries can actually get together and reform the European Union, well then why would you not take some other course of political action? And I think that's precisely what David Cameron did. He tried to get a deal. He tried to bring supposed reforms back to the British people. They weren't happy. They were weak tea reforms, and so we moved to a referendum. And so I would encourage you to think about how Brexit doesn't preclude cooperation, how it doesn't preclude good relations, how it even doesn't preclude free movement for certain nations and for certain jurisdictions in Europe. I think you can have very free travel. You can have pretty easy residency arrangements across all the jurisdictions.
Oh, yeah? Where does this fantasy land that you've just described come from? Because I know, as a European citizen, rather British citizen, living in Rotterdam, I know that in 6 months' time, I've got a letter this morning, I'll read it out to you if you want me to, in July, you will have to leave the Netherlands if Brexit goes ahead. So how is that productive? How are the hundreds of thousands of people that are living in the UK from European countries, whether it be East European, Southern European, Central European countries, how is Brexit going to help that? I mean,
the Johnson cabinet has already come out and said that EU nationals in the UK will get very, very favourable treatment. You see, all this is up for negotiation. There's no. You're treating Brexit. You're taking the worst case outcome of a scenario, but it's in everyone's interest. It's not in the Dutch's interest to expel you from Holland, and it's not in London's interest.
It's been It's been 3 years now, and they've got 3 weeks. So 3 years gets condensed to 3 weeks. Politicians are messing up my life and hundreds of thousands of other people's lives. It is pathetic.
Okay, so what you're saying is that the status quo then must just always remain in place because that's the most comfortable and the most easy situation. I think.
Don't you want your life to be comfortable and easy? Don't you want the political system, the fiscal system, the monetary system to be easy and comfortable? I do. Why be so bombastic? Why are these people so nasty?
So I think that you've contradicted yourself because you've just said that you would want to reform the European Union, and now you say that you're happy with the status quo. That's the first comment. The second comment is if everyone was so comfortable, why did 17.4 million people vote for Brexit?
Because they're not qualified to vote for anything. That's why. I mean,
are they not qualified to assess their own material comforts? All these comforts that you say are so manifestly apparent about the union. Why didn't so many people feel it so obviously and clear? And I think one way to explain that is to explain them as being stupid. Another way to explain it that I think is far more productive is to say, hang on, there's real grievance here that was expressed at the ballot box. And I'm choosing to ignore that grievance, and I'm choosing the rule by technocrats in Brussels. And I think that's precisely what's gotten people very angry about this whole process.
Why are so many people wanting a second referendum then? Why are so many people saying, well, actually, 3 years ago when we voted, we didn't realise that this was going to be the outcome of our initial vote. They were swayed by people like Boris Johnson, who's a blatant liar. He misled the people.
Well, we don't know how many people want a second referendum. We do know how many people voted for Brexit in a real referendum. But if a second referendum was truly desired, I'm not necessarily opposed to that. I do think that there's no reason to not implement the result of an actual referendum. But certainly a middle ground on this debate is we have to have a general election.
Yes.
And again, your pro-Remain parliament is blocking another general election or the next general election. And I think that's rather criminal. I mean, it seems quite contradictory to me to complain about how Boris Johnson is supposedly subverting democracy, but at the same time vote against a general election. This must happen. And I think a general election is going to be run on, if it happens before Brexit has happened, it's going to be run on a pro versus anti-Brexit platform in every constituency.
Well, also a hospital versus no hospital. He said to himself, he said to the world, he said, I'm going to build 40 new hospitals. Obviously, he's going to call for a general election if necessary and if the constitution and the law of rule in the UK allows him to do so and if the Queen allows him to do so. The point is, he's an unelected leader. And he's unpopular. There is a state of flux going on in the UK now. Anyway, let's not talk about the UK anymore. Let's talk about South Africa because you're exhausting me, Russell.
I think you need to be exhausted on this because I think you've got a lot of potentially contradictory positions. I mean, you've just said, for example,
yes,
that Boris Johnson is unpopular, but the Conservatives have been rising in the polls since he came into
power. It's only because Jeremy Corbyn is...
Jeremy Corbyn was there. Jeremy Corbyn's been there during Theresa May's reign as well. Yeah. So you say he's an unelected leader. Let's have a general election. Now, my parting shot on this is in a general election, you're going to get pro versus anti-Brexit candidates, and it will double up as a second referendum, and you're going to kill two birds with one stone. You're going to have a second effective referendum, and you're going to have a general election that hopefully leads to a lot more legitimacy.
If you had a second referendum now, it would be 60-40 in favour of remaining because the youth of the United Kingdom...
Polls don't support that, and they certainly don't support that unanimously.
I don't believe polls.
Okay, well this is, I think a lot of your beliefs on this are hanging on, you're clearly a Remainer, and that's fine.
Yes, please.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with being a Remainer. But I think that is tainting some of your argumentative judgment on this issue. I mean, Boris Johnson has proven to be very popular in the polls, and we should have a second another election.
He's not popular at all. He's popular amongst the elite. He is not a popular leader. He's unelected and he's not popular. Let's talk about South Africa now, because when we talk about South Africa, we think, oh well, there's a political maelstrom here, and indeed a political vacuum when it comes to the ANC, and so we shouldn't be too worried about the fact that the UK has more or less the same situation prevailing. Let's talk about South Africa now. Give me your thoughts on this country. Come on now.
Gosh, after all that, I'm
tired as well. I need to lie down.
I'm a little spent, Lindsay. Let's not spend too long on SA. I think SA is. I don't think a whole lot has changed. Whereas I think Britain is, as we've just been discussing, is an incredibly fluid and changing political environment. South Africa remains with its core problems intact, if you like, and so we aren't. We're in desperate need of a shakeup as well, but we're not going through it. Whereas they are in the UK, for better or worse. We desperately need some major shakeup, and what we've got is, I think, a pretty ineffective president who doesn't really want to make too many changes. He's very conservative. He wants to keep the kind of status quo in place, which is ongoing ANC mediocrity, zero growth economy. He's appointed a panel of economists it's another panel that's been appointed. The president doesn't want to take any hard decisions. I think the economy is being deeply corroded from the inside out. I think our productive capacity in South Africa is under serious strain and is declining. Our retail economy is under huge pressure. So if you look at our macroeconomic trajectory, and you look at the companies and the quality of the companies that are on offer to you in South Africa on the South African Stock Exchange, I think that it's not a very appealing prospect. Some fund managers think that there's some value in the market, that it's gotten cheap, but you know, there's value trap dimensions to this as well, because earnings are suffering as the economy shrinks and declines. And a last point on this is, a huge factor in that is the immigration trend that is, I think, extremely damaging to South Africa's economy. So it's hard to quantify what immigration is doing to South Africa now. Back of the matchbox calculations that I've done, suggest that it could be lopping off a full percentage point of GDP every year. That's an unscientific estimate, but it's something that I have put together with, you know, using some stats and using some common sense. Which means that every year we're starting 1% in the red when it comes to GDP, and so we're really just a zero growth economy. And this is of course very worrying, and it means that allocating to equities in South Africa is a very, very difficult game, and the results are showing that.
Two things that have really stood out in the last minute and a half of your diatribe. Number one, zero growth economy. We're a zero growth economy, whereas the rest of Africa is growing in various parts. And the second and more telling word that I picked up was mediocrity. We are mediocre. We are really mediocre, and we could be absolutely superior, I think. That is Russell Lamberti, the exhausting Russell Lamberti, who's the founder of ETM Macro Advisors, based in the Western Cape. That podcast was proudly brought to you in association with sharenet.co.za. Visit strictlybusinesspodcast.com and subscribe to receive exclusive content straight to your inbox.